Today's talk session picks up from the line of George Bernard Shaw that Robert F. Kennedy made famous. Some men see things as they are and say, why? I dream of things that never were and say, why not? And that why not spirit is what I'm hoping to help rekindle today, both in this audience but in our society at large. And my objectives are to help you go out there and change the world, to give you some tools that allow you to do that, I hope, a little bit more easily, to have some fun, and to inspire you. It has not been easy these days. There's a sense in which we have retreated, decide to fall back on the tried and true, and I think that's not going to get us out of our problems, that we're going to need some new ideas, and I'm hoping to help you feel more comfortable, a little easier in terms of coming up with some new ideas. To some extent, I'm going to try and automate or routinize the process of ingenuity. And to the extent that I can make it less creative for you to be creative, actually the easier and the better it will be. So my tools that I want to bring to you are four. Half of them start with a problem and look for an answer. And half of them are like Jeopardy. We start with the answer and then look for the problem. And what you're going to see through this session is first some really simple finger exercises, if you want. We're not going to start with Mideast peace, although we may get there. We're going to start with what I'll call old-fashioned ingenuity, kind of Ben Franklin-esque problems. Stuff that is sort of no-brainers, could have been done 50 years ago. My favorite example of that is right turn on red, pretty low-tech idea. The cultural contribution of California, according to Woody Allen. And believe it or not, most of Europe does not have right turn on red. Now, I understand why England doesn't have it, but it's not as if there hasn't been a demonstration effect to see why this works. And simple ideas like that, that don't require a PhD, is really what I want to be focused on, what might be called old-fashioned ingenuity. The first tool that I want to bring to bear is we call what would Croesus do? What would somebody who has all the resources in the world, how would they go about solving the problem? And our modern-day Croesus that I use as the example is Donald Trump. So let me illustrate this just by doing a problem with you. Imagine it's 2 o'clock in the morning, you're lying soundly asleep, and the phone next to your bed rings, wakes you up. You pick it up and you hear, it is a fax machine that is calling your bedroom number. What do you do? I'm sorry?
Hang up
and 5 minutes later it's going to call again.
Turn off the phone.
If you have more than one phone, it's going to be a problem because those other phones will ring in your house.
Leave the phone off the hook.
It makes a different noise. Plus, if there's an emergency call, it won't come through. Speak into the phone. So you communicate back. So if you can speak fax, you'll be fine. But that's I haven't learned that. Fax. I see. If it hears a voice. So if you have a home fax machine, great. You could call forward to your office fax. If you have an ex-boyfriend or girlfriend, you could call forward there. Okay. You got to be pretty awake. Caller ID and block the last number. That could also work. So we've come up with some reasonable solutions, but I note a couple things. First, it actually only solves the problem after you've been awoken. And two, it really requires a reasonable amount of thoughtfulness, awakeness, to actually get there. So now what I want to do is put aside the way we've approached this and use the tool. So the tool is, what would Donald Trump do in the situation? And let's see what type of answers we come up with. And my claim is, we'll come up with an answer that is, in fact, not practical, but we will be able to translate into something that is practical. And it's much easier to shift an answer than it is to come up with one from scratch. So what would Donald Trump do in the situation?
Fire his phone.
He'd have an apprentice, somebody to answer his phone for him. And clearly, that's a great solution. It works before you're woken up the first time. So now we have the answer. We just have to go and make it practical. So how can we do that? Who could answer the phone for us and screen our calls very cheaply? So one, we could have a machine try and do it, although that would require perhaps programming a white list of calls that go through or a black list of calls that couldn't. Seems still a little complicated. I'd like a human to be my screener. So a nighttime answering service, a little bit like a doctor's office. And even if they charge me a buck a call, it's not often that I'm going to be screened, that I'm going to need it, so that wouldn't be that expensive. A front desk. Who could do it even cheaper? I'm sorry? So I could outsource it to Inner Mongolia. They're awake. Okay.
A phone company.
So in some sense, like an operator service. I want somebody who will screen the call for free. So who do I know must be awake?
You're overseas.
Someone in another time zone. But they probably won't do it for free. I want somebody who I know is awake.
Mm-hmm.
The police?
No.
I'm sorry, I heard it?
The person who's calling me.
Rather than screen the call at the receiving end, why not screen it at the calling end? So I want to hire the caller to screen my calls. So let's take your idea of the machine. Imagine they get the following message. Hi, you've reached the Lubars. We don't currently wish you to be disturbed. If it's an emergency, hit zero. The phone will ring. We'll be mighty annoyed, so it better be good. So I basically told the caller all the information they need to screen my calls. They'll know if it's a wrong number. A fax machine won't know quite what to do. And basically, it won't be perfect. Some people still hit zero when they shouldn't. But I think actually we'll get 99% of the way there at essentially no cost. The technology already exists. We already have the hit zero, and the phone of my attendant will ring. And by the way, this product, since we wrote the book, now does exist. You can get it for VoIP services via AT&T. And in fact, it's the centerpiece of their campaign. It's sort of some mother in Italy who can't figure out time zones. Okay, so now you've got this tool. Let's apply it to two other problems. Textbooks. We know that our high school kids have just way too much weight in terms of textbooks that they're carrying. What would Donald Trump do to solve this problem? Yeah, so I think actually you jumped to the answer, but yes, I think that's right. So he might actually hire somebody to carry the books for his kid. But the other option, which sort of gets you there, is have two copies. And you say, well, that's going to be twice as expensive. I don't think so. I think the school board says to the publisher, if you want us to adopt this book, you have to sell us the second copy at $2 or something. And so then we can have them at home and at school. What else? Put in a laptop. So later on with digital rights management, Microsoft will allow us to do it that way. But in the meantime, what's another way of making the books half as light, half as heavy?
Put them on an electronic book.
So electronic books, I think we'll get there. But before we get there, so shrink the text or
break the book
in half. Right? Any of you actually gone on vacation, taken a paperback, and as you're reading it, kind of ripping out the chapters? It's hard. I know it's painful as an author, but actually, it's not a crazy idea. Or for guidebooks, we're like, okay, I'm done with Greece. Let's see what's, you know, it's now I can have Italy there. And it seems to me you should. I got you a sec. You'll take some textbooks, and you could literally rip them in half, have two indices, and for the first semester you have the first part, and the second semester you have the second part. Sir.
Books on tape, iPod.
Books on tape, iPod. So that, of course, be a. When we get to the point where people are doing audio or being able to read on a screen. But in the meantime, for the actual books, I think we have two solutions, both of which are actually very inexpensive, that would significantly lower the weight. Mortgages. How do you decide when to refinance a mortgage? Well, it's kind of complicated. And there's lawyers and appraisal fees, title insurance. How would Donald Trump figure out when to refinance all of his mortgages?
He'd pay someone to tell him.
He'd hire some MBAs to figure it out. We can't do that. Who should we hire to figure out when to refinance our mortgage? The mortgage broker, or who has the data? Really has the data? The bank. So let's hire the bank to figure out when we should refinance our mortgage. They know what current interest rates are, what I'm paying, how much is left in my mortgage. Now, I bet somewhere here in this audience there's a banker who realizes the problem with this. So it's not in their interest. I didn't say I wouldn't pay them for doing this, by the way, because it's a very valuable service to me. And right now, the money's going to the lawyers, the appraisers, and the title insurers. I'd like to split that fee with the bank. And so what we've done is created a new product called the Auto Refinancing Fixed Rate Mortgage. And I have to pay for it. There's three ways I could pay for it. I could pay higher points up front to reward the bank for giving me the lower interest rate later on. I could pay them when it refinances and just split the savings with them. Or my preferred alternative, when rates fall by 1%, my mortgage only goes down by 0.5%. And so I split the savings with them. And now I just never have to think about what's going on with interest rates. So instead of making 1% for me for 6 months until I refinance, now they'll make 0.5% for me for the whole mortgage, and I just don't have to worry about it. For who? Sounds expensive for who?
For the consumer.
No, because I don't need to get at the bottom of the interest rates. I'm not going to try and refinance. Remember, if it goes down another quarter, I save another eighth. And so my goal in life is I don't have to hit the trough. I mean, I've got other things to do in my life. I just don't want to be stuck at a high rate when things fall. So if I get halfway to the bottom, that's good enough for me.
Oh, and you also premise this that you're Trump.
No, actually, now I'm not Trump. Now I'm me.
Now you're the consumer.
Right, and so the fact is, it takes me a while before I refinance. It has to fall by 1.5 points before I do anything. Now I'm saving something even before that happens.
This is only in a declining
market. Oh, there's not a big advantage of refinancing in an increasing market. So what I hope you'll take from this is the following perspective, that watching customers, doing focus groups, all very helpful, very useful, also very expensive. I'm proposing watching a different customer, one in your head. The customer we always carry around with us, who's totally empowered, totally rich, will solve any problem. And customers don't always have that inclination. Ours, our Croesus, our Trump does. We come up with the answer, and then we just have to modify it. And I think modifying impractical solutions is a lot easier than coming up with answers from scratch. It also helps us to think big, because when we approach the facts problem, we generally don't solve it before it happens, whereas with the Trump approach, we actually solve it right from the start. That's the first tool. Let me move on now to the question of incentives. How do you, with the case of Trump and what would Croesus do, we looked at a person who was going to do things incredibly well. Now what we're going to do is flip it and look at cases where people do things incredibly poorly and ask why. And often the answer is because they were led there by really poor incentives. When you understand the incentives that have misaligned or messed people up, it's really easy to fix the problem. You just change the incentives. If I told you all restaurants were all you could eat, what would you think about that? Well, it didn't matter where you went. Well, the food is different at different restaurants. What's the problem with that?
Encourages overeating.
Encourages overeating, because basically you might as well have seconds and desserts. And I believe in college that's called the freshman 10, maybe freshman 15. That basically you're exposed. Yes, sir? Changes their incentive in terms of what food they provide. So it's a real problem. If I told you gasoline were sold on an all-you-could-drive basis, what would you think?
Drive on
basically gives you way incentives to drive too much and to buy fuel inefficient cars. Okay, pretty obvious. Well, auto insurance is sold on a all-you-can-drive basis. If you drive 10,000 miles or 100,000 miles a year, you pay the same amount for auto insurance. And auto insurance costs almost as much as gas in many states. Now, what's the solution? Pay as you drive. Basically, the more you drive, the more you pay. Pay per mile auto insurance, which can be done in many fashions. It could be included in the price of gas, which also then solves the problem of uninsured motorists. It can be done via monitoring the odometer, and that's good enough for car leasing. If you drive more than 10,000 miles on the lease, they'll charge you for it. Same thing in terms of insurance. And it can be done via GPS. Oh, and by the way, women drive half as much as men, get to half as many accidents, and pay the same amount for auto insurance. Yeah? This is not about trying to the redistribution away from men to women was a notion that people are cross-subsidizing. But the real point of this change was to get incentives to be better. And in the case of the mortgages, I was redistributing money from the lawyers and title insurers to the customer. But ultimately, what I'm trying to do is make things more efficient because I don't really want to spend my time thinking about when to refinance. Banks are going to actually make, first off, banks are making more money on multiple accounts. One, they make money servicing the mortgage, and now they're going to keep that mortgage for the whole life, so they'll get to service it the entire time. And two, actually, under my scenario, banks are going to make the same amount of money or more. What we're going to do is take money away from the title insurers, the appraisers, and the lawyers. That was the point. Not that I'm going to pay a lower interest rate on average. I'm paying a lower interest rate now because I refinance. And now I won't have to do that. It'll happen automatically. By the way, Citibank holds many mortgages in its own portfolio. If you call them to refinance a mortgage that Citibank currently holds, what they'll do is they'll say, oh, we can just modify it for you, and you don't have to refinance. All I want is Citibank to tell me, guess what? I'm holding your mortgage in my portfolio, and I'd pay you a premium for that because that's a great service. They don't advertise it. I want my mortgage to be one they're holding. Jesse?
You just rationalized the insurance, auto insurance business from a consumer point of view. What does this do for the insurance company?
The insurance company actually is fine, too, because basically it is now eliminating the cross-subsidies. Now, it's a problem for existing insurance companies because when they start charging Jesse more, he may decide to go elsewhere because if they're going to charge women less, they're actually going to charge the high drivers a little bit more. Let me give you an example in terms of Blockbuster. Their business strategy for many years was managed customer dissatisfaction. Essentially, when you went into the store, they didn't have the video you wanted. Why? Because Hollywood was charging them $99 a tape. That meant that Blockbuster had to have very low inventories so they could constantly churn their tapes, one-day rentals, and high late fees. So people hated them. How do you get around that problem? How do you get Blockbuster to have a large inventory and at the same time let Hollywood make its money?
Lower the price of the
tapes. Can't just lower the price because then Hollywood is losing out.
Oh, you lower the price of the tapes, encourage more frequent rentals.
But people aren't going to rent necessarily that many more movies.
Pay per rental.
Exactly. So essentially, revenue sharing. And they moved to revenue sharing. As a result, they lowered the initial price to $10. Now Blockbuster has large inventories, has guaranteed in-store delivery, one-week rentals, gets rid of late fees. The result of all that was a giant spike in their profits. It may not ultimately save them from video on demand, but you know, as they say, seven fat years are good for seven lean years. And that's the best you can often do. In my own world, we have a problem with grade inflation. One of the things I've discovered is that if I give students an A, they tend, A, not to ask for a regrade. B, they tend to give you higher teaching evaluations. And three, it helps them with their jobs. So, you know, why not give everyone A's? It's basically, the problem is when I do that and everyone does that, essentially grades don't mean anything. So how can you give me as a faculty member better incentives to give out meaningful grades? Jesse?
At Davidson, the dean gives a lunch every term to the faculty with the lowest grades.
Well, at Davidson, they reward people giving low grades, but that seems to be counterproductive because I may have great students, and I don't want to penalize the fact that I have wonderful students to get the cheap lunch, which is probably all I can eat. Reward me for a curve.
That would reflect what people are really doing.
That reflects things, yes. Would you be kind enough to help with some passing things out? This is my substitute for PowerPoint. In Connecticut, one college reports to all the faculty the grade distribution for all the other faculty. And peer pressure is pretty effective, because if I see my colleague, there are not enough copies for everyone. So I'll ask you to alternate in terms of what you're doing. So peer pressure is pretty effective. But my favorite is actually what's done at Indiana University. And on the transcript, what they do is for each course, they list the entire grade distribution. So in the course of capital punishment, there were 6 students who got an A+, 9 who got an A, 8 who got an A-. This student who got an A+, was in the top 6 out of 26 students. In contrast, in the Vietnam War, the student who got a B+, was actually better. That person was in the top 56 out of 321 because there were only 3 A-pluses and 10 A's in that course. And so it was harder, relatively speaking, to earn a B+. Moreover, if you look at it, the class average, the department average in history was 2.36 for the Vietnam War versus 3.78 in criminal justice. So it says that that department's a much harder department. You might also wonder if the course, maybe everyone should get an A because they were all superstars. So you have on the left the average grade point average of all the other students in that class in their other courses. And so you can see, is this a class filled with A students or B students? And you can also see what fraction of students are in that major. Well, when you put a transcript out like that, now I have no longer any incentive to give all my students A's because effectively it would devalue what I'm doing. And my view is that if I told you to do this type of transcript, you would have said, it's impossible. And in fact, that's what my colleagues told me until I found this. Now, some of you are parents of high school students. And I bet some of you worry about the fact that they may have a teacher who's a little tougher than some of the other teachers. And that B that they got is actually a great grade, but the college won't know it. So I'd love to work with you to get high school students, high schools, to put the grade distribution on the transcript. And that way you can worry a whole lot less about whether or not some teachers are easier graders than others. And moreover, colleges, I've spoken with deans of admissions, and they would love this. Because right now they have to go through all sorts of hieroglyphic exercises to understand what these transcripts mean. And it depends on having a lot of experience with the school. Oh, I know Mrs. Brown. You know, how much can you really want to count on the college admissions officer knowing the teacher? It's just unreasonable. Whereas this transcript essentially eliminates that need. Please.
The student's review of me.
Well, I'm tenured. So it's a little bit less of a problem these days. Okay.
Wait, but there is a serious answer to that, which is that it equalizes everything. So if you're a tough grader, you're an easy grader.
The serious answer is that in the end, my goal in life isn't to bribe students to get good teaching evaluations. My goal is to get accurate ones, and as a result, I can live with what it says. And actually, the tenure part isn't facetious either, which is that ultimately. It doesn't really matter. I don't have to go and get great evaluations for that purpose. What I've also done in terms of getting more honest evaluations is the two-way anonymous feedback. I want students to be able to give me feedback anonymously, but not that. But I insist that I can reply to it because essentially it will. They'll say things that are really not thoughtful and sometimes even hurtful if it's totally anonymous. Moreover, oftentimes they actually just want an answer. So how do you have somebody give you feedback anonymously that you can respond to?
Numbers.
I'm sorry?
Number.
But I need to respond to it.
A number box.
What I've done is I encourage my students to all get Hotmail accounts and just come up with some... yes, thank you for Microsoft here. Essentially... now, some of them haven't quite understood it, and they put their name as the... but, you know... okay, what can you do? So I now explain to them that's actually not the... but it's very helpful. They sort of say, why did I pick on Kip? And the answer was, well, I sort of saw that she was a little bit confused. I really wanted to make sure she was understanding it. It was nothing personal. And maybe that was Kip who was asking the question. Maybe it was somebody else. And I think it's been really terrific. And by the way, it also, I think, works for daycare centers. I don't really want to complain to the person taking care of my child and have them sort of take it out of me, but I also want to have a chance to communicate with them in a way that allows them to also respond. And I think in general, for these 360 feedbacks, having the ability to respond anonymously, and then often the people will reveal themselves, is something that would be very useful. We're done with the first half, where we start with a problem and look for the answer. Now we're going to flip things and start with the answer and look for the problem. And in particular, what I mean by flipping things is I'm going to take an answer, turn it upside down, and ask what problem this solves. So here is the product innovation of the year in 2003. What did Heinz do?
Eliminated the problem of the ketchup stuck at the bottom of the bottle that you can't.
But what did they do?
They
turned what upside down? They turned the bottle upside down?
Label.
Yeah, I already stored my ketchup like this. So my view is they just turned the label upside down and made the cap a little bit bigger. And in the process, changed their slogan from Carly Simon's anticipation to no anticipation. Right? You get to use more ketchup this way.
They increased share.
Absolutely.
In fact, they increased total consumption.
It was terrific for them. We have these handouts. Where did I give them to some? Trying to figure out where they all are. Here they are. So can I, again, get your help on this? Here's actually, you may even just be able to see this. Can you see this?
Yeah.
So this is what Target or Target did. They took their prescription bottle and turned it upside down. And in the process, gave them a lot more real estate to list what the medicine is and the contraindications. And they believe that the process is going to reduce errors significantly. So this has been their focus in terms of their pharmacy. Now, this next picture is really, it isn't any better even when you see it on PowerPoint. So I apologize for that. Can you tell what this is?
No.
It's a Christmas tree hanging from the ceiling. And you can see that the ornaments, here we can actually pass these out. Why don't you do that? You can see the ornaments are hanging so nicely. Also, if you live in a New York City apartment, you often have more ceiling space than floor space. And, of course, there's more room for presents. And, you know, people joke and think, oh, my God, you know, come on, be serious, hanging Christmas trees from the ceiling. But actually, this year, Hamischer Schlemmer introduced this product. It was sold out. It was their best-selling Christmas tree ever. And Target also did it and, again, made fantastic sales with it. Well, this one actually is a hook would be fine. You got a hook in your ceiling. Well, you have a rafter or something? Okay. Here's the next one. Would you be kind enough to pass these around for me? And you got to split them up first. So the question is, how do you peel a banana? So what are some options here? So you can peel you peel from the bottom, so right here? Well, bananas grow like this, so this is the bottom. So most people, don't peel it yet, those of you who have the banana. Most people peel the banana like this, which kind of does, kind of squishes it right here. What I want you to do is put your thumb right there and just go like this. And what you will discover is that when you do this, seems to be a little stringy compared to most. Normally the stringy things come right with it. You get a built-in handle that since it grows from the bottom up, this is the top, your first bite, by far the best. It's really perfect.
This reminds me, and I know you're a Jewish person, I don't know if you know of Ali G, he's the English brilliant comic who puts people on. And he went to Donald Trump with an invention. He went to a bunch of manufacturers, I don't know if anybody saw this. It was a glove to wear when you're eating ice cream so it doesn't drip on your hand.
So I'm serious. I'm actually not trying to... No, actually, this is... So, first off, if you have any doubts that this is the better way of eating bananas, I'll pass it on. This is actually how monkeys do it. And you think they actually might know something about this. So here, if you'd pass this around. But the other point, and the larger one, is that we get complacent about things. that we decide there's some right way of doing it and we don't explore other alternatives, as opposed to thinking about flipping it and saying, what if the other way is actually better? How do you eat a bagel and cream cheese? So here I have my bagel and peanut butter. Now, what's the way that you eat this? Well, most people would eat this product just like this. What's wrong with that? What's wrong with that is our taste buds are on our tongue, not on our palate. And if you eat it like this, what you will discover is an explosion of taste, because right on the tongue. I don't think so. I don't suggest doing this if you have too much jelly or you have salmon. Honey might be bad too. And in fact, if you do this with bagel and cream cheese, you can save a lot of calories because you can use a quarter as much cream cheese and get the same flavor. So now I can see you go to the Aspen Institute, and what did you learn? Well, I learned about Northern Ireland peace. I learned about liberalism and conservatism, and I learned how to eat a banana. Thank you so much. And you know, you can take this further. How do you eat ice cream? Typically, people take the spoon and put the spoon on their tongue and the ice cream on their palate. But as any kid will tell you, they'll put the spoon upside down and have the ice cream on their tongue. Do you put coffee in your milk? How many people here put coffee in your milk? How many people put milk in their coffee? See, the people who put milk in your coffee, you have to stir it. But if you put coffee in your milk, you don't have to stir it. And Dunkin' Donuts actually eliminated the Twizzlers and countless hours in a much better way of doing it. How do you eat sushi? Most people dip the soy sauce, the rice, into the soy sauce wasabi, put the rice, soy sauce, wasabi on their tongue. In Japan, they dip the fish in the soy sauce wasabi and put the fish on their tongue. You spent all the money for the fish. Ladies and gentlemen, enjoy it. And if you're doing it the other way around, it's actually you're mostly getting too much soy sauce wasabi and tasting the rice. I'll have a little bit of fun. Here's a case where they get it right. First off, name tags are way too small. And the other problem is, why are they in the front? What you really want them to be is in the back. Because that way, when I'm going around and, I'm sort of here and I don't really know your name, I can pretend I do. Because it's really much more embarrassing when I have to go like this. And as Elliot knows, the Rhodes folks actually went and did this. And it really is just terrific. And so I encourage you actually here, maybe, for the rest of this, you'll go and take your thing and put it in the back. Or maybe we'll even get two-sided ones going in the future. My co-author in this project is a lawyer, and he's Ian Ayers. He's an expert on contract theory. And we're both annoyed by those signs, which you see when you park, which say management is not responsible for loss to my person or property for useless establishment. Right? You've seen those. So we created our version. Notice, management by serving me is responsible for any loss to my person or property for use of this establishment. They have their sign. I have my sign. We can see who wins. I'm sorry?
Who does win?
Actually, Ian claims this would be a legitimate notice. And it's and almost more visible to them than the one they posted up high above the cloakroom. My students said, okay, well, let's see. Can you turn everything around? They gave me this T-shirt. This is a Flasis. They're Liparod tablets. When the moment is wrong, will you be ready? Do I need to explain that to you, sir? Do you think there's a market for that? Now here I am up on stage. Got to write. So I was doing this, and a fellow from Delta Airlines said, okay, take our slogan. We love to fly, and it shows. And flip it. Well, let's be clear. How many people do you think love to fly? And do you think the flight attendants at Delta love to fly? Right? Isn't it more accurate to say we hate to fly and we know it? And in fact, actually, if you thought about that, part of what they should be doing is recognizing that you hate to fly and actually making it a little less apprehensive. So they could give you tapes. They could give you download for iPod, something for fear of flying, for apprehension. They could do things in terms of... sound canceling inside the whole plane. They could recognize this whole issue as opposed to pretending that it's actually a love experience. I'd love to get where I'm going, but the experience inside the plane is actually not what does it for me. Or take Lay's potato chips. What's their slogan? Bet you can't eat just one. I'd much rather a potato chip whose slogan was, bet I can eat just one. Because in fact, actually, that's my problem. I mean, they're telling me, if I eat this thing, I'm going to overeat. So I'd pay a lot more for the bet you can eat just one potato chip. And in fact, actually, we're just starting to do that now with portion control. And in fact, actually, they have this Belgian chocolate company which gives you chocolates with dates on them, one for each day of the month, as opposed to you're not supposed to eat a whole month at a time. Turning to more serious flips, the... sorry, just give me one sec here. This is a... What I want you to be able to do... we have miles per gallon is how we measure fuel efficiency in cars. What would the flip of that be? Gallons per mile. Now, why should I care, miles per gallon or gallons per mile, right? I mean, but the fact is, each year, we don't go and say, I'm going to buy 1,000 gallons of gas, I wonder how far I could drive. We say, I'm going to drive 10,000 miles, I wonder how much that's going to cost me. And if you had gallons per mile, then you can multiply that by the price of fuel times how much you're driving, and you actually know what it's going to cost you. Actually, what you probably want is gallons per 100 miles, so we don't have decimals. By the way, in Europe, they do it that way. It's liters per 100 kilometers. And the thing is that you can go from 40 to 60 miles per gallon or 10 to 15. Both are 50% improvements. But going from 10 to 15 is four times as important as going from 40 to 60. Why? Because the car at 10 miles per gallon is using four times as much gas. We get all excited about the Toyota Prius getting 60 miles per gallon and will it be a 100 mile per gallon car? Actually, our whole focus should be on the 10 mile per gallon cars, getting them up to 15. All of that becomes evident when you do gallons per mile and gets hidden under miles per gallon. Let's flip, what does a microwave do? Cooks, heats food quickly. Flip that. Cools food quickly. So I'd love to have that product, and actually I could cool down my tea quickly. Well, there's a new type of cooking in Chicago where they essentially flash freeze things. What else? Cools, heats food quickly, heats food slowly. Ah, sous vide. Sort of another type of cooking style that's coming up. And so I take a notion, I just turn it around. A 900 number, what is that? Some of you may know. A phone number where you pay per minute, not what you do with it, no, but it's the horoscopes, computer support lines. It's a phone call where you pay per minute for making a call. If I were to flip that, you get paid for receiving a call. Okay, it obviously won't work for sex lines, but what could it work for?
Telemarketing.
And polling. Basically, while they're trying to sell you a product, you can sell them your time. And the pollsters won't have to lie. They won't have to say it's only going to be 1 minute or 3 minutes. Since you're getting paid 50 cents a minute or a buck a minute, sure you don't have any more questions.
Why do you...
I'm serious about this.
No, no. Why do you take it even further? Why did you actually establish by legislation a right to everyone's personal time so that you actually have
We now have the opt-out list for telemarketing. And what I'm suggesting is that's an infinite price. What I want to do is be able to set my price. And I could have different prices on evenings and weekends than during the day.
But what it will do, I won't drive you further. What that will do, it will drive them back to using direct mail. How do you apply it to direct mail?
Well, so I could also actually charge them for putting something in my mail slot, as far as I'm concerned. And by the way, the next application of this is not only could they pay for making me a call, they could also pay for sending me an email. And that leads to the... 5 cent or 1 penny email postage, which, by the way, is refundable in the sense that I only collect it if I want to, and that eliminates spam. Because right now we're trying to do everything with filtering and Bayesian and sort of search for words, But if every email coming into my box has to have a penny that I can take away from the person who sends it, none of my friends will, I won't penalize, but and even sort of long-lost acquaintances. But if it's a spam and I'm upset at them, I can now ding them a penny or a nickel, and now we can stop people from sending out 5 million emails. So the flip of the 900 number not only actually rejuvenates telemarketing and allows polling to take place on cell phones, I think it's also the seed for the solution for email spam. I talked to the whole group about switching from opt-in to opt-out for organ donation. There's a lot of other places you want to do opt-out for. For example, 401k plans. It should be the standard is that you are contributing to it unless you choose not to, as opposed to you have to opt-in. And one last example, you can prepay your mortgage. What would the flip of that be? Get a credit if you pay early. That is actually what prepaying your mortgage is. I want to turn it the other way around. Pay all at the end. They pay you. Sometimes it's literally just undoing it, so let me try the deprepay. So think of it this way. I'm ahead of my mortgage schedule. Why can't I take it back? Not quite. So it's almost like a reverse mortgage, but it's a reversing of the prepaying. So think of this way. Many of you will have cash, and you'll also have a mortgage. Why don't you take all of your cash and prepay your mortgage? Well, because you may have tuition payments or tax payments or need for emergency spending. But your mortgage rate of interest is generally better than what you're getting in CDs, money markets, and so on. So you should take all your investments and prepay your mortgage if you could get it back. Now, you can if you're super sophisticated. You can take out a home equity line of credit, use that to prepay your mortgage, and then go up and down your home equity line. And what I'm proposing is just including that as part of the standard mortgage. And by the way, that product was created in New South Wales, Australia, brought to the UK by Virgin, sold to the Bank of Scotland for £150 million, and yet doesn't exist in the United States. It essentially becomes your checking account, your savings account, your credit card account. Everything is your mortgage. And they even give you savings accounts that pay your mortgage rate because, in essence, those savings accounts are the prepayment of your mortgage. Susan.
That leads some people who are, let's say, not good at budget managing to be defaulting on their mortgages?
It may. But on the other hand, for the vast majority of people, it is a much smarter, more sensible, simpler way of managing your finances. And by the way, I'm forcing you to be ahead on your mortgage. This is only if I've jumped further. So I've prepaid. I still have to go along the mortgage track. But if I have extra cash now, I can put it there. So in some sense, I'm being more fiscally responsible because I'm ahead of my mortgage. And I just don't have to be extra ahead. That is the flip side. The last tool is the notion of translation. Simply intellectual arbitrage. Taking an idea that works in one context and asking, where else could I apply it? So I don't have to be so smart as to come up with the idea. I just have to understand why it works and where else could I do it. So cup holders. I love cup holders. Oftentimes car reviews are based on the quality of their cup holder. Where else could we use cup holders? Strollers. Whiteboards. My desk. My hip. Right? Like my cell phone. My favorite place is airlines. That... You know, one of my worst personal experiences is I was sitting next to somebody, and right as the plane was taking off, I spilt my beverage all over him, and then had to sit next to this fellow for the next 7 hours. It was really a sticky situation. The fact is, you say, well, where'd you put the cup holder? Air France is the one airline which gets this right. They have a hole in the tray table that the cup fits into, and when the tray table's up, they have these two little fingers that stick back. And it works actually brilliantly. Okay. Other simple translations. You know, we have little beeps to open our car door. What else would I like to open up that way? My house, exactly. Jesse reminded me we have little scrolling news things underneath often a TV show. Or sports, where else can I put those scrolling items? Computer, so we actually have them sometimes now. Put them underneath advertisements on TV so that basically you can get the sports scores or stock reports or breaking headlines and give you a reason to actually watch the ads.
Do the other way. While the sports is playing, just have a small
have the ad scrolling. That's the sort of flip the other way. We can think about the content up above, the ad below, or the ad up above and the content below. We could do it both ways. Okay? Let me turn to what I think are some very serious translations. I realized I skipped over some serious incentive ones. So let me give you at least one serious incentive one, too, or two. I want my life insurance, my health insurance company, to treat my life as if it's worth $1 million. I want to take all the preventative steps that they would to keep me alive, to keep me healthy. So I'd like it, really, if I die, they have to pay a $1 million penalty to give them the right incentives to keep me healthy. That, I think, would do it. Now, how can I get them to pay a $1 million penalty if I die? Seem at all possible, practical? Well, who pays $1 million if I die? My life insurance company. Why don't I have my health care provider provide me with life insurance? That way, if they keep me healthier and alive longer, they save money on the health insurance, on the life insurance. I understand, but I want it to. I don't want it to. That's my point. I don't want it to be two different departments. Exact colonoscopies at 20. And actually, you know, again, it's not the whole solution, but part of it. Imagine to the extent to which the Israelis had stock in the Palestinian stock market, and the Palestinians had stock in the Israeli stock market. Then they each have more direct vested interest in the economic success of the other. Okay, sorry. Back to translations and serious ones. The IRS, in its wisdom, the government passed a rule that allows you to make contributions to an individual retirement account until April 15th of the following year and still deduct it on your taxes. Do you all know what I'm talking about here? Right. It's a great idea. It actually encourages people to save more. I didn't come up with that idea. What else could I use the delayed deduction for? I'm sorry?
Contributions to charity.
In fact, December 31st is a terrible time for the tax deadline for charity. I often am busy. The charities are busy. I've got other resource constraints on me with Christmas presents. And moreover, until I do my taxes and fill out Schedule A, I generally don't know how much money I've given away. So what I'd like is actually at the time I understand my giving, and the immediacy of the tax benefit would be the perfect time to have the tax deadline. Now you say, well, it's crazy, it's impossible. But actually, last year, Congress extended the tax deadline to January 31st for tsunami relief. So all we have to do is extend it to April 15th and make that permanent. Moreover, I think we can, in the process, change tax day to charity day and create a national norm. How many of you know what fraction of income your parents give to charity? How many of you have taught your children what fraction of income you give to charity? One. Two. Okay. This, I'm taking as a pretty philanthropic group. And yet, in fact, we teach our children how much to tip. We generally don't teach them what's an appropriate amount to give to charity. My father told me I should give till it feels good, which is apparently more than when it hurts. But I didn't think that was really specific enough. What do you think the national average is for giving to charity? 1%? 5%?
0.5%.
Okay, so first point, we don't seem to know, which is pretty interesting, right? If I asked you what the tipping rate is, you'd actually be able to give me that answer, but not for charity. The national average is 2%, with half going to religious organizations, but it's been declining lately. And again, as part of tax day, I want everyone on their tax form and TurboTax to calculate what fraction of income you've given to charity. No consequence of it, but you should know that. And then we can also have in the newspapers the what those national averages are, and so people who are below average can step up to the plate. I think people who are above average know it and are happy about that. Judaism has this very funny rule that before you can convict somebody of a capital crime, you can't have a unanimous vote. You think if you're going to fry the guy, you know, I want it to be unanimous. But they want somebody to play the Henry Fonda role in 12 Angry Men. And then 24 hours later, you can have a unanimous vote. In Catholicism, before you elevate somebody to sainthood, you have to appoint a advocatus diaboli, a devil's advocate, somebody to make sure the other side of the arguments are all heard. In Shakespeare, we have the court jester. In Parliament, in UK, we have the question time. This tool of the devil's advocate we see as a very successful tool across religions, across time. So I didn't invent it. Where else could I apply it?
Hiring situations.
Hiring situations. Business decisions. So, by the way, in tenure decisions, I think, and I've taken that role at Yale to explain why it is that I think we shouldn't promote this person. And that doesn't mean I won't vote for them, but I want to make sure we've really had the right arguments, because even when it's obvious that the person's going to get appointed, we generally don't have the discussion. And I don't want to do it because then they'll beat up my candidate next time. I'm embarrassed to say, but Stanford, not Yale, actually institutionalizes that. And then business decisions, I think on the board of directors, there should be an official devil's advocate who can make sure their discussions, not necessarily to overturn the CEO, but the CEO is like the Pope, a very powerful person, and you want to make sure that all sides are heard. I can tell you that Turo, the snowblower lawn care equipment company, has institutionalized this policy, and before any merger or acquisition or a significant decision, they have a team make the case to the board for the opposite decision. That team generally loses, but that's okay. Israeli intelligence does that in terms of a blue team and a red team interpreting any set of facts. And that I think there are many opportunities to create devil's advocates without actually having it be a disloyal opposition. Let's actually have the election. We have TIPS, Treasury-indexed bonds. What else might want to index to inflation? Well, we saw it earlier today, mortgages. So instead of you can lend at inflation-adjusted rates, or you can borrow at inflation-adjusted rates. And we see the advantage of that. Insurance.
Tuition.
There you go. So, again, take an idea that works in one context and ask, where else can I apply it? You don't have to be original here. I think it's a line from Tom Lehrer, don't close your eyes, plagiarize, but steal from everyone, not just one, and sort of mix and match. Those are the four tools. I'm not claiming they're going to solve all the problems you'll face. They won't. However, I think they will help stimulate lots of ideas, and may, if they get the 80-20 rule, that works pretty well. Let me tell you where I've taken this in my own life. I've created a website. Oh my God. I'm sorry. I forgot a key one, so I apologize. This is another translation. So this is an answer. This is something called the Spin Pop. It is a motorized lollipop spinner. It's sort of what Donald Trump would do. He'd have somebody else turn his lollipop while he licks, okay? So this is the most successful candy dispenser since the Pez. It was invented by two guys, and actually, let's see if I still have the... There's another page here I'm hoping I can find. Yes. This is the patent application for that product. I couldn't have come up with that. And the guys who did this sold it for $15 million to Cap Candy. And like I said, did quite well. So my question to you is, here you have an answer, sort of a $3 spinner. What other questions could you solve with this problem?
Lint.
Earwax. No. I'm sorry? Twirl spaghetti. Yeah, I'll give you a hint.
Dig a hole for a garden.
Stirring. you've got the answer, but you've got to come up with a better question. Think big. Think several hundred million dollars.
Well, the
exactly. The fellow who not the inventor of this, the guy who was marketing it, John Osher, walked up and down the aisles of Walmart and said, what else could I do with this device? And came up with the spin brush, which became the most successful toothbrush, never mind electric toothbrush. Instead of a $50 electric toothbrush, you have a $350 electric toothbrush. Sold it to P&G for $450 million.
Wow.
Okay. So you had an answer, but it was the wrong question. Better question. Now you have another choice. There's another product that has been based on the same technology that had $100 million sales last year. So all you have to do, screwdriver, not enough torque. Remember, really cheap, low power.
Drains.
So you have the answer, folks. What's the question?
Is it bigger than a brand?
That is the product, yes, sir. How does it work? You just... Oh, it's for kids. They have ones that aren't, but I had to borrow from my daughter.
Sorry. Can we see the lollipop one more?
Sure. You can come up afterwards, a nickel a shot. No.
Why is it going around?
Why is it going around?
No, it is going
around. That's the whole point.
No, I'm not. No, we couldn't see it.
Oh, sorry.
Can it be reused? Can you put another lollipop
yes.
on it?
Yes, you can. It spins right here. This little thing, this bristles here. Right there. No, it doesn't. Hey, $350.
For cleaning.
Exactly. So Dale gets it. It is the Dawn Power Spin Brush, which you use for cleaning your dishes or your toilets. Please buy two. And, I had one other handout that's a little disappearing on me, so give me another. Ah, here we go. No? Yeah. Ah, here we go. Would you be kind enough just to hand these out? So in my own life, I've had a chance to take some why not ideas and bring them into practice. One is I want to... I recognize, and I think it's true, especially the people who've managed to stick around this long, that you all have more ideas than you know what to do with. And the question is, what do you do with them? And so, again, with Ian, we've created an open source movement for ideas, whynot.net, where people contribute their ideas to make the world a better place. Because, as I say, in general, what are you going to do with the ideas that you have? And so here, the top-selling or top-ranked idea is a better brake light. So when you slam on the brakes, your brake lights shine brighter. And so the car behind you can see that you're braking quickly. And then somebody else adds, well, why not change the light color from green to red? Why not have it strobe? Why not have a rear-facing horn so you get an audible as well as a visual clue that there's an emergency up in front of you? And then somebody says, well, let's have multiple horns. Let's have the, excuse me, sorry, thank you, for different messages you might want to communicate. Another person says, let's have digital alarm clocks with a telephone keypad so I can actually type in the time rather than have to scroll through. Right? I mean, does that make any sense how we sort of just, you know, I can hit 7:35 and I'm done. Colored salt so you can actually see how much salt you're putting on your food. Now, what I want to point out about that is that there are many good ideas that I don't think are good businesses. And colored salt is in that category because, in the end, if you succeeded with it, essentially you'd be doing test marketing for Morton's. And so while we may have good ideas, that doesn't mean we should be the ones who go and implement them. In my own case, I thought that a huge problem for people was that their houses are highly leveraged, highly undiversified, and that's where all their assets are. That means when housing prices go up, they make a lot of money, but when they go down, even by a little bit, they're stuck. And so working with HUD and Neighborhood Reinvestment, we actually created home equity insurance. And people who live in the city of Syracuse can now buy insurance to protect them against losing money on their home.
Wow.
perfect for Syracuse.
You're doing it in Stockholm.
So they're doing that in the stock market, betting on the pricing.
Yeah, so you'll soon enough be able to buy index contracts on this. But this is a very simple, for the life of your whole home, you don't have to roll it over, 1.5% once. Now, normally, when there's insurance, people behave more risky. So you drive faster if you have car insurance. But here, people are willing to buy in declining markets. With economics, you know, price falls, demand goes up, not in the housing market. People don't want to buy into a declining market. But when they have insurance, they're willing to take that risk. And in fact, actually, since we've offered this product in Syracuse, the housing market, instead of having 10 years of straight declines, has turned around.
Wow.
Dale.
We
price it at the time you buy the house. It's 1.5%, one-time fee, and you can't collect on it for 3 years.
Okay, but if your house goes way up,
then
you're
not insuring against gains. You're insuring that.
Well,
if you buy a house for $1 million, which is impossible in Syracuse, you could actually buy a neighborhood. If your house goes down 10%. You gain 10%.
From the original purchase price.
On the original purchase price. But the problem is when housing prices fall, you've lost your down payment, you can't move, you can't refinance, jobs have moved, and you're stuck. In this particular case, HUD provided the seed capital. It's a product which is, you need to make national in terms of getting geographic diversification and time diversification. You don't want to write all your policies on the same year. And so it's a product that's actually hard to get into the market, but once it's there, actually, it's not that difficult to figure out how to price. Working with one of my students, Seth Goldman, I thought there should be a beverage that actually was not liquid candy, that actually sort of more flavor than water, but just 1 or 2 teaspoons of sugar. The first lesson we teach in economics is declining marginal utility. So a little bit of salt is okay. By the time I put too much salt on, I've ruined something. A little bit of sugar takes away the bitterness. The next little bit makes it a tad sweet. By the time I put too much sugar in it, like Snapple or Sobe, I've turned it into liquid candy. If you go into a restaurant and you watch people have iced tea, they generally put 0, 1, or 2 teaspoons of sugar in their tea. Why was everything in the market 10 or 12? And so with Seth, we created a company called Honest Tea, tea that actually tastes like tea, and we're now the #1 tea in the organic food world, and Consumer Reports just gave us the #1 ranking in the current issue. So in the future, perhaps we'll be able to sponsor Aspen, and you know, we'll join Fiji in this world, but I think the what you want to look for is something that looks a little bit like this. And let me know what you think. Actually, how many of you have tried this? There we go. So,
is it sweetened?
We have unsweetened teas, some with 1, some with 0, some with 1, and some with 2 teaspoons of sugar. 0 to 30 calories, depending. We use honey, maple syrup, agave, and organic cane sugar, depending on which product.
No fructose.
And all organic. So with that, let me leave you with the inspiration from Gandhi. You must be the change you wish to see in the world. I hope you will take this why not attitude, go around and say people, why not? So thank you very much. I'm happy to stick around and answer questions. Sir, I think you were...
As I understand, the biggest difficulty about launching beverage is getting distribution.
So I launched the company before we wrote the book. Let me think about that. The tool that I've used the most that has somewhat been frustrating to me, but we made a little progress on, is I think several of our distributors can make more money as investors in our company than selling our tea. And I've been encouraging, and now with some success, getting our distributors to invest in our company. Because their ability to succeed by helping us become a national brand is ultimately much more than what they'll make in a year or two selling our tea.
So
That's in the incentive category.
This is not product oriented, but how do you get people to see the glass half full instead of half empty?
I think part of what I've done in terms of emphasizing some of these little solutions is getting them to see changes they can make in their own community. At Yale, I created a program which brings in undergraduates right to the MBA program. And actually, those of you who were right in the beginning, which did the principal problem solving. So what is the rules? If you get an MBA, you need work experience, because nobody will hire an MBA without work experience. But it's very expensive to take 2 years off of work. So what we do is take people right out of college. They go for 1 year of an MBA, then go and work, and come back and finish it in 1 year. And what's terrific about that is their work experience, they know something, because they've learned some finance, accounting, and then they're only away from the labor force 9 months. Now, having done that, I have a whole lot more credibility to bring other innovations to market. In fact, my biggest ambition, and I've talked with Jesse about this, is I want to create a television show where people actually talk about their ideas, show how they're making them happen, and you can see it in this community, then you bring it to others. So we talked about the organ donation example. We have in airports, when you fly internationally, they have a place to give your coins, to your foreign coins, or foreign cash even. I'd like in front of every airport screening device in the United States, when you empty out your pockets, there's a place to actually make a contribution. And we go and do it in Hartford, and you can then go and do it in Denver, because you've seen it work, you understand why it's successful. And so one way of dealing with this half empty full thing is there are all sorts of people who have ideas who are just being kind of kicked back, said, no, there must be some good reason why this hasn't already happened. The market's efficient. If it was a good idea, it already would have been done. And actually we discover it often has been done somewhere else. And it has been successful. We just don't know about it. And allowing these why notters to find each other and share their ingenuity and get reputation for that, to me, is a way of changing our psyche. And I actually, like I said, I think the TV show could help in that same way. I do have a few extra copies of Why Not, if those are interested. You can lighten my load for bringing them back. And again, I'm happy to answer questions, hang around. Thanks very much for being here. Okay. You can?